Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 200. What is error culture, and how do you avoid it within your organization? How do you navigate alert and notification fatigue? It's episode 200. Real Python's editor-in-chief, Dan Bader, joins us this week to celebrate. Christopher Trudeau also returns to bring another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss an article series about error culture. We dig into false positives, hero culture, and the tendency to start ignoring alerts. We contrast our personal experiences and propose possible remedies. And Dan describes configuring Real Python's alert system. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a news roundup, reading and writing WAV files in Python, moving beyond flat files toward SQLite and SQL Alchemy, getting help in Python, exploring four kinds of optimization, a framework for building web scrapers, and a project to simplify sub-processes. This episode is brought to you by Sentry. Fix application issues before they become downtime with Sentry Error and Performance Monitoring for Python. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right. Welcome to episode 200.
Yes.
It's been interesting. I got invited to be on the PyBytes podcast, kind of trading with Bob Belderboss, who was on the show a couple weeks ago. That should maybe have come out just before this one comes out. So if you want to learn a little more about me and my coding journey, hopefully there's some new stuff in there. But yeah, this week we got, of course, a bunch of articles and projects for you and discussion this week. But we have some news. Some of it may seem a little out of date because a lot's happened in the last couple of weeks, but I thought we could at least provide some resources for people that want to do a deeper dive and get an explainer.
Yes, for sure. So first little bit is that the folks at PyPI are hiring a support specialist. The job is a new role, and it's taking on work that's currently being done by volunteers. The position is to help with things like account recovery requests, other account change requests that aren't self-serve, helping with documentation, similar kinds of tasks. You don't have to be in the US. The position is remote, but you do need to be willing to travel to PyCon US. The application process is open until May 1st. Of course, details are in the show notes. And then the second bit of news also involves PyPI. So on March 27th, PyPI temporarily halted the creation of new projects and new signups in order to stave off a supply chain attack. There was an automated process attempting to create malicious typo squatting packages. And to stave it off, new accounts and projects were halted for about 8 hours. There was a banner on the site to tell people what was going on. On one hand, it sucks that this is now the world we live in.
Yeah.
On the other, kudos to the folks at PyPI for protecting the rest of us by being on top of this stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of wild with it mentions a bunch in the article about the automated tools that allow for this to happen and then having to combat that, which is definitely going to be this cat and mouse thing. But it's nice that we have people in these positions now to really help. It can also help us in informing us what's going on.
Yeah. And this is, we're seeing it everywhere, right? It isn't just Python. The exploit that's been in the tech news a lot shows you just how far people are willing to go to do nefarious things.
Yeah.
For anyone who isn't aware, XZ is a compression library in most Linux distributions, and an individual or a group acting through a single account, depending on how paranoid you want to be, spent a lot of time putting a backdoor into the library. This was a multi-year endeavor where they sort of gained trust. The library is used in things like SSH, and this would pretty much be a backdoor through any SSH connection. The perpetrator was very patient. They took over the maintenance of the library and slowly made modifications without being detected. And it gets really messy where the code versus the built piece weren't matching. And so they were sneaking things in that way. And so thankfully it did get detected, and that's great, but it's got a lot of people nervous. And you were mentioning there's a off show, you were mentioning that there was some sort of situation with build if you're building Python yourself.
Yeah. So we're going to include a link to a pretty good explainer article by Ars Technica. They always do a good job of that kind of stuff, kind of wrapping a lot of these resources together to explain it. And I remember during the sort of Easter weekend, following threads and things that were happening on Mastodon, it was definitely a place to be in the tech world, especially people that are involved in, you know, open source, which Fastodon has a lot of people. I did see a CPython announcement, and this is from Seth Michael Larson, who I think he's the security developer in residence, and he typically posts these types of things, and he posted on there that CPython, PyPI, and many Python packages are not affected by the backdoor, and has an explainer post taking people into that, and then there's a kind of a nice thread beyond it. So the malicious backdoor was committed in, I guess, versions 5.6 and 5.6.1 of XZ. And so they were talking about that. And then the top comment right below it is somebody talking about it's becoming a bit of a challenge to download 5.2.5 of XZ if one is building Python from source, as the current GitHub repo has been made offline. And so this is, again, during a lot of this several days ago. I know that there was a little bit of struggle there. This might give you some details as to what's happening behind it. But again, if you're not building from source, you're probably fine and your versions of Python should be all good to go. But if you're involved in open source development or you're doing your own kind of packaging stuff where you need to build from source, this might be a good resource for you to learn a little bit more what's happening and at least be up to date with what other people were doing with this challenge, if you will.
I've got one other thing I want to talk about. You took the wind out of my sails a little bit up top by announcing that it was episode 200.
Okay.
But I do want to spend a little bit of time on this. In addition to it being episode 200, it's also our 50th episode together. I don't know how that worked out by complete coincidence, but it did.
Well, it was funny. I remember you doing episode 100 and you surprised me on that one. And said, hey, wait, you're going to let that just go?
Yeah, so, yeah, well, buckle up, buttercup, it's coming. So yeah, so it's been 50 episodes for us together. You've tolerated me that long. That's quite an accomplishment.
Yep, I laughed at all your jokes.
Exactly. checks in the mail, buddy.
All right.
For those who don't know, in addition to hosting the podcast, Mr. Bailey here also oversees the video courses for Real Python. And although I've done a bunch of teaching, the video stuff for me was very much a fake it till you make it sort of situation when I joined. And I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge how much I've learned from you over the last couple of years. Pretty much everything I know about audio I learned from you, which probably explains why I've spent so much money on my rig.
Yeah.
As for the podcast, you know, you've grown it from nothing to the beast that it is today. Riding your coattails has been fantastic. Why build your own audience when you can attach yourself to someone else's hard work? You're amazing at it. You bring a love for the topic to the podcast, and, you know, you've built a loyal following, which is very well deserved. Huh. And folks, if that's not enough, Mr. Bailey is a genuinely nice guy, an all-out warm human being. It almost amuses me to watch his discomfort when he has to give me feedback about something. He's always worried about how it's going to be received.
Oh my God, yes.
It's an absolute pleasure to work with you. Thank you very much. And in honor of hitting 200 episodes, I do have a little surprise. We have an unannounced guest. Dan Bader, the editor-in-chief of Real Python, is going to join us. And thank you in person for all your hard work.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Here he is.
Surprise.
That's great.
Super happy to be back on the show with you guys. And, you know, I just want to say congratulations to the big 200. It's kind of a mind-blowing number, really, right? Especially when you break it down into the years and weeks and months. So yeah, just wanted to say huge congrats. Thank you so much for the great work. It's just been a pleasure to have this show on Real Python, or sort of have it be part of the Real Python family / media empire. And I think it adds a lot to it. And you started completely from scratch. So getting to 200 episodes is really amazing and an amazing achievement. And then also for Chris Trudeau. I believe this is episode number 50 for you, which is also a really great milestone. Thanks for being a part of this. And thanks to the both of you, and obviously also the rest of our great team and your partner.
And we've tried to have everybody on.
yeah. We got to get Kirsten on the call as well. Thanks for all the editing.
Yeah, true.
No, it's just been such a great show that I really enjoy personally as well. And I think a lot of people do. And I'm honored to be back on it, and double thumbs up to the both of you.
Thanks. Yeah.
And in honor of episode 200, you now have to try to edit out the sound of a crying baby in the background.
Yeah, that's right. That's something that's changed too.
That's not a hurdle I've had to do. So
we can do it again. We can do it again.
Occasional barking dog, but crying baby's new.
Yeah, I've done barking dogs. I've done... oh my gosh, trash trucks. That was a fun one. Yeah.
Yeah, we might get that in a couple of minutes here, actually.
Oh, okay. No.
it'll just be in my truck, yeah. But I'm curious, I mean, how does it feel for you, you know, looking back on 200 episodes, so many guests, so many conversations. I mean, it's just hours and hours of fun, you know, chatting with folks. It's amazing.
I had Mike on the show, you know, from Talk Python, Mike Kennedy, and it was like 5 years for them, and it was kind of weird to talk to him. I'm like, oh wow, what a milestone, and so forth. And now I feel like at 4 years of doing this and 200 episodes, I'm like, wow, okay, that went faster than I thought. As I look back and think about, you know, guests that I've had on, and it feels like, oh, that was just like a year ago. No, that was 3 years ago, and so forth. So it's been quite the blur. It's been interesting intersecting. Going to PyCon has been interesting the last 2 years. Unfortunately, I'm not going this year, but it was great seeing people in person. They would always joke with me that they would hear my voice and they would then come over and say, yeah, I've been listening to the show and so forth. Of course, I listened to it at high speed. It's just always kind of a weird one. But yeah, it's been really great. And it's been fantastic having people reach out and tell us about the show and that they like it and suggest guests and topics. And yeah. It's kind of wild to think about. I joked with you when I was, you know, I always say this story to other people that I came to Dan and said, well, why don't we have a podcast? And I feel like your reaction was, I don't have the time. Do you want to do a podcast? I was like, sure. Because I already had the experience of trying to do one on my own, and it died, as many podcasts do, within 20 something episodes. It's been great because Real Python has this great audience and, you know, membership of people that are really interested in it. And so that was, you know, kind of building on top of what Christopher was saying earlier, this ability to kind of have a lot of people like right out of the gate, check it out, was fantastic and really helped us. And we definitely have grown since then, but it right out of the gate, there were a lot of people that were interested, and you did all the back end stuff, which was kind of fun, which is definitely, we'll talk a little bit more about architecture later in the show.
Yeah,
but
sure.
That's definitely your bag. So yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's this stat that I'm going to get the numbers you know, wrong basically, but directionally it'll be accurate. Like I think 95% of podcasts don't make it past episode 5 or something like that. Maybe it's 80 or, you know, so it's like it's a very high percentage. And so to get to 200, that's definitely past the great filter of podcasts there. So that's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, we do have some topics to cover this week and a discussion, and it'll be fun to have Dan included on that, because then we can talk about our own errors and things to think about there. So that'll be kind of fun to dig into. But I have the first topic this week, and it's a Real Python article from previous guest who was just on the show, Bartosz. This is about reading and writing WAV files in Python. I think Bartosz actually kind of hinted that he was going to talk about this. And this is as Martaj does, an extremely detailed deep dive into working with audio and especially in the wave format inside of Python. I think it's great that it includes so many code examples. Not only are they written into the tutorial, but we've have this new trend of always having a downloadable link so you can grab them inside the piece and play with the code yourself. If you don't want to necessarily copy and paste things in and out, you can definitely do that. If you're interested in playing with audio Python, it's definitely more of an intermediate piece, but it's a great resource and you can definitely come back to it. Lots of additional links that are embedded within it to dive out. And I learned a lot kind of digging into it. Being a digital audio person, I have not played with it as much inside of Python outside of maybe using some other libraries. And I was a little kind of surprised that there's this Wave library built in, which is really cool. It's part of the built-in library. So he starts out the whole thing talking about understanding the Wave file format, understanding kind of the history of the actual like computer file format of it, and then digs into what's being captured inside there, along with the frequency being captured, the sample rate capturing the oscillations of seconds of audio, but then the amplitude being captured by bit depth. And then a little bit about the structure of how that's put together into the file format itself, how it has metadata, encoding information, channels, along with the sample rate, frame rate, and bit depth. He talks a little bit about the idea or the concept of how audio is captured, which is pulse code modulation. This is part of my own history. I taught at a school for audio engineers, so I have a lot of background in that stuff and can bore somebody very quickly with all my information about that if you're interested. But I think he did a good job of giving you just enough to get going with it. And like I said, you get to know Python's built-in Wave module. He has you read in Wave audio, play with it a little bit, look at the metadata that's in there, and then actually see how the data is sort of stored, which is interesting. Then he has you create a Wave file, in this case, doing kind of a little bit of synthesis, I guess you'd call it, creating a playable file, just using math, creating a sine wave. And then he does another example where he's creating something with alternating tones. I know he's very, very excited about doing more with that. He's talked about making kind of a sort of a bit of an instrument library kind of thing, which I think is very cool. Mm-hmm. We'll see how that comes out.
Little synth.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so he talks about mixing and saving stereo audio and coding with what you kind of get with higher bit depths. And then he takes you into this area that he's got it titled as Decipher the PCM Encoded Audio Samples. And through that to the kind of the end of the whole article, he digs into building your own sort of Python package that he calls Wave.io. It has four different modules in it and they are used kind of throughout the rest of the examples. So I don't want to spend too much time or spoil all of it in there, but things you get to do that are pretty fun. You get to not only play with building these libraries, but you get to look at maybe how you could use them to build visualizations of this stuff, like plotting a static waveform in matplotlib, reading slices of audio frames, things that you can actually make sort of command line interface stuff for that. Things I was not expecting. He has actual like visualizers for the waveform playing live inside there, which is kind of interesting. Has one with like a spectrogram where you have like the lows and the highs going, recording audio from a streaming source, like an internet radio station. And then kind of a fun little bit of a processing thing of like widening the stereo field. So there's a lot there and a great resource as all of his articles are, where you can kind of come back and check it out and learn a little bit more as you kind of dig into the audio world using Python.
Odd little tangent, but we just recently built a course on flattening lists of lists.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a common homework and interview question. Ben, if you dig around on the internet, you'll find it in pretty much almost all programming languages, but you almost never find an actual example of where this gets used. And WAV files is one of those places where this gets used because of the structure of how the left and right channel works. You take bits for the left, bits for the right, and then flatten it all into a stream. And so this is actually one of those spots where you can actually see the data processing involved in flattening lists of lists. And when I was putting the course together, I was like digging around, asking people, can someone give me a real example? And Bartosz was like, oh, well, hey, this article's about to come out. And here it is on line 17. Look, I'm calling Flatten. And I'm like, oh, excellent. So there you go. So yeah. So even if you're not into audio and you want to learn about flattening lists, there's a real world example buried in this article. So.
Yeah, totally. Cool.
This could be our first audio only course.
Exactly. Nice.
Fix application issues before they become downtime with Sentry error and performance monitoring for Python. One engineering leader that used Sentry said the time to resolve errors went from days to minutes. Whether you're taming Python's processing power or controlling JavaScript's flow through Node.js, backend infrastructures are as complex as they are valuable. With Sentry, you can trace issues from the front end to the back end, detecting slow and broken code to fix what's broken faster. Within minutes after installing Sentry, software teams are able to trace Python performance issues back to poor performing API calls, as well as surface all related code errors to fix what's broken faster. Installing is just 5 lines of code, and RealPython listeners get 3 full months of the team plan free with the code RealPython on sign up. That's RealPython with no space. Check it out at sentry.io. So what's your first topic there, Chris?
So I'm also hitting up a RealPython thing, and it's been a while since I've been self-involved, so I'm talking about one of mine.
What?
This is SQLite and SQL Alchemy in Python beyond flat files, and it introduces you to relational databases, how to use SQL, and then how to use the library that's most popular for SQL in Python, which is SQL Alchemy. So SQL Alchemy has 3 different approaches to interacting with a database, and the course covers all 3 of them. The first approach is using the text function, which essentially allows you to write SQL text and then pass it into the function. And of course, it supports parameterization, which prevents SQL injection attacks, meaning your code can be safe from little Bobby tables. shout out XKCD. SQL Alchemy's second approach is function-based. So instead of writing SQL text, you call functions in the library. So for example, when you're looking for something in a table, you would normally use SQL's select command. SQL Alchemy provides a select function, and that structure ends up being very similar to the SQL language itself. The benefit of using functions instead of writing text is now the Python compiler can catch certain kinds of errors for you, rather than waiting until the database call to find out that you spelled select incorrectly. And then the library's third approach is an ORM, that's object relational mapping, and that uses object-oriented techniques to map classes to tables in a database. So instead of calling select on the author table, you call it on the author object and then iterate the results. And the key benefit to this is you're now thinking as attributes of the object rather than, say, columns in the database. And it tends to map more closely to how you think about these things in your code. So you move away from using, you know, generic dictionary type calls. And for anyone who's paying close attention, you might say, hey, didn't you do this course already? And yes, the answer is I did.
Yeah.
The original version of this came out over 2 years ago and was based on SQL Alchemy 1.4. SQL Alchemy has since moved into 2.0, and the major release number corresponds to a whole load of breaking changes. The 1.4 version was meant as a bridge between the 1.0 world and the 2.0 world, but it still wasn't fully 2.0 compatible. The primary difference between 1.4 and 2 are related to how columns get mapped to relationships inside of the ORM. And so with some minor changes to 1.4 code, you can make it work in 2, but there's some things added in 2 that actually make your life easier. So the new release of the course switches to the 2.0 world. It covers most of the same topics, but gives you the 2.0 specific approach. I guess that's sort of the problem you always have with releasing stuff onto the internet. Given enough time, it becomes wrong. So there you go. I'll say, if you're not tired of hearing my voice, then here's a way to hear my voice and learn SQL Alchemy. So there you are.
Another hour and 12 minutes of
exactly.
Chris T. Yeah. But this is, I just want to say, this is such a nice course because I think it's such a foundational topic, you know, the way you approached it, where, okay, you're moving beyond flat files. Maybe you're starting out, you have a little Python script, you're just writing data out to a text file. And then, you know, as we've all done, data corruption happens, or you accidentally overwrite some of the data, you lose it, and maybe that's really bad. And so you start thinking about, okay, well, what might I use instead? And so you're then on this path, and SQLite, I think, is a fantastic choice for like a local project or just running this locally on your file system. And so I think that makes a lot of sense. But then in this course, you're also learning about SQL Alchemy, which basically allows you to connect to any database because it's kind of abstracts that away. So you could then, you know, use any of the cloud databases, find your MySQL or Postgres instance somewhere, locally hosted or in the cloud, and you're off to the races. And I just like so much how you approach that in the course, where it's really the skills that somebody is picking up by going through the course. It's not just going to help them. They're not just going to help them in this sort of limited environment, but it really opens up the whole world of, you know, the exciting world of cloud storage and database storage.
Yeah, and relational databases is a lot in there, and how the relations work, a little bit about this concepts of like schemas and stuff like that, and lots of kind of real examples. You use books, I think, is the main thing throughout it, which...
Yeah, authors, books, and publishers, yeah.
Which is complex. There's lots of relationships inside there that you kind of think about, and separate tables for them. So I think there's some good examples.
And SQLite is this weird little superpower. It is the most popular database on the planet, and no one has heard of it, right? It's a programmer thing, but it pretty much is used by almost all the apps out there. So like my mother is using SQLite on a regular basis. She has no idea.
Yeah.
It's deeply ingrained in the day-to-day usage of tech. So it's really, really, really strong skill set to have.
Yeah. And it's such an amazing software project too. I believe this was originally started for some military project way back when, and then open sourced. And SQLite, so the project itself, they're very diligent with their kind of development methodology. They have very specific kind of style guides and what features you're allowed to use in writing code for the database. And then their test coverage is, I mean, it sounds amazing. They have this page on their website. It's called How SQLite is Tested. We can definitely link to that in the show notes, where they go into a lot of details. They have, I think there's hundreds of thousands of test cases that they run. So it says here, just to quote this, prior to release, they're doing about 248 million tests that are running against any new release of the database. And so they're not going to have a lot of regressions with this, I would assume. And I think it's a project that's known for the stability, seeing it's being used on Android, on iPhone, internally for all kinds of things. And like you said, Chris, you don't really realize it unless you go into the sort of license documentation to learn about it. And it's just such an amazing project that's been going strong for such a long time. There's a lot of interesting background that you can find on their website and kind of how they got to this really high quality level and this high reliability that I found really interesting too.
So my next story, I always kind of hesitate to cover really, really basic concepts on the show, and then I have to stop myself. And the reason that I think about that is there's somebody starting to learn Python today. At every moment, there's new people coming to the language, and there's always something that also old timers and me, this sort of middle timer, can learn from these concepts. And so this article is titled Getting Help, parentheses, in Python, and it's by Ishan Arora. The blog is called Pulsar's 17's blog. Ishan was traveling in the Delhi metro to like a Python meetup and was wondering about the sleep function and thought, oh, this would be kind of a cool thing to maybe present to a group, and couldn't quite remember where do you find sleep. So opened up a REPL session, the read, evaluate, print loop, you know, after you type just Python or Python 3 in your terminal, and just typed in sleep, and of course, not found. And so tried to import OS. Is it os.sleep? You know, where is where does sleep live in this library inside of this language? And if you're unsure yourself, it's part of the time library, and you do have to import that. So import time,
which sleep, is insane.
Which it is a type of time, but I won't get into the discussion of why and where it came from. Maybe we have somebody on to talk about it. But they said, well, let me use help and see if it can be helpful here. ended up down a whole path. Like, well, what is here? And so forth. And again, if you're in a REPL session and you just type in help with parentheses after it, like you're calling a help function, it spits out this friendly little intro. Welcome to Python version number. So in my case, it's Python 3.12's help utility. If this is your first time using Python, you should definitely check out the tutorial at docs.python.org and the version number tutorial. Enter the name of any module, keyword, or topic to help on writing Python programs and using Python modules to get a list of available modules, keywords, symbols, or topics. Enter modules, keywords, symbols, or topics. And all those are with parentheses after them. So each module also comes with a one-line summary of what it does to list the modules whose name or summary contain a given string, such as spam, enter modules, spam. To quit this utility, hit Q. So at that point, it shows the word help with a little caret, kind of a separate prompt than you're used to, maybe the triple prompt that you are normally seeing in the REPL. And if you type the word topics, all caps, you'll see all the different topics that are covered inside of help. It's a little interesting. You do have to use all caps on these things. I would think that maybe they could have adjusted for that. But so you could type at the prompt help and the word lists, all caps. And then you get this, you know, big detail, and it's straight out of the documentation from Python. It's a very, very useful tool. You can, you know, of course, type help. And when you're in the normal REPL with just the triple prompt, help, and then put in whatever you're interested in learning a little bit more about. It's nice that you have, if you will, this copy of Python docs right here built into the language. And if, again, you haven't played around in this environment, I think it's really useful. I talk a lot about alternative REPLs. In fact, Dan introduced me to BPython back in the day when I was starting to make video courses. And I love it because it's very, very friendly and shows you a lot of additional information and takes advantage of that along with color coding and so forth. We've mentioned PTPython. We've mentioned, you know, IPython and some other kinds of tools. Lots of other things that are out there. Friendly tracebacks, I think, is another one that we've talked about. But these tools that are built into Python are really great, especially for beginners to help themselves. And one thing that they brought up in the article that I think is really great also is that sometimes you need this type of documentation and you do not have internet connection right now. And this is something that's in the language, it's ready to go, and it doesn't have to call out to the internet to bring it in, which is nice. There are other tutorials. I'll include a link to one where we were sort of exploring scope and using a function like dir that's built in also that can kind of show you what's happening, the concepts of debugging. These are things that as you start to learn the language a little more or trying to learn the language that you can use to kind of help you along the way. How does this function and kind of provide this information? I thought it was a nice resource and a kind of a neat introduction to playing around with help. All right. Christopher, what do you got next?
I've got a post by Lawrence Tratt, who's a prof at King's College London. The post's called Four Kinds of Optimization, and this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. When mentoring programmers, even some senior programmers, I often find I end up having to spend time trying to instill the fact that we all suck at knowing where a program is actually spending its time. And expending effort to optimize your code before even running it is almost always a waste of time. Even if your so-called optimization works, it often makes the code harder to read, so you might even be wasting your future self's time. So the post starts with two observations, which I'll just read. First is, human optimism leads us to believe that we can easily know where a program spends most of its time. And second is, human optimism leads us to believe that we can easily know how to make the slow parts of a program run faster. So right off, you can tell he's a kinder person than I am. I would have used the words unexplained stubbornness, but he went with human optimism. So, you know, good for him. But really, what we're tackling here is the fact that we're bad at this. And Lawrence goes on to identify four styles of optimization: using a better algorithm, using a better data structure, using a lower level system, and my personal favorite, which is basically giving up. He calls it accepting a less precise solution.
Yeah, sure.
It's not quite giving up, but we'll get to that. For each of these four styles, he goes through examples. With the better algorithm one, he sort of talks about the choice between, say, bubble sort and selection sort. And, you know, that typically gives you a 3x performance boost. But the key word in that sentence is typically. And understanding things like the best, average, and worst case performance of an algorithm is important to thinking about optimization, because the case that you're in might be the worst case, and you might actually end up in that weird place where quick sort is not the answer. At the end of the post, he also sort of comments on the importance of human time. He warns against spending time on complex optimizations. The time you're spending on the optimization could far outweigh the gain that you're gaining, particularly if it turns out there was no gain at all.
Right.
And that last one I was sort of hinted at there was, which is accepting a less precise solution. That ranges from let's just deal with this to there's actually a style of optimization where there are certain situations where you can be less precise in your calculation, and that can speed things up significantly. So by, you know, switching from fixed to, say, floating point might mean you can use the GPU, but you're going to lose some of the precision because you're not using fixed, for example. And so understanding when to do that can have a big gain as well, but that's a weird little edge case.
Yeah.
It really reminds me of all these recent developments in running these LLM, large language models, running them locally on your computer, and all this work that's gone into essentially like compressing the model weights down or sort of truncating them from the full like 32 bits float or whatever that I was maybe trained on down to 16, 8, 4. And I think I just saw an article about like 1-bit truncation. I don't know how well that's going to work. I guess if you have enough parameters, it's going to be fine. Not my forte for sure. So take everything with a grain of salt. But I think that's essentially similar to, or it the concept that's explained in this article, where it's like, you can shave off some of those bits, and then you might be able to actually get this thing to run in, you know, a reasonable amount of time and give you an answer, but it might be even more inaccurate than it was before.
So and there might be another version tomorrow.
Yes,
that's right. Faster GPU tomorrow. Yeah.
While I'm up on this particular soapbox, there's one thing that I often bring into this conversation that he didn't actually talk about in the article, which is Amdahl's law. And this is typically used in the hardware world, but it applies to software as well. Amdahl's law states that the overall performance improvement gained by optimizing a single part of the system is limited by the fraction of time that that improved part is actually used. So in other words, a billion times speed up on code that never gets called provides little purpose. Mm-hmm. And I find this all the time, right? Like a developer will look at something and go, oh, well, we have to make that faster. I'm like, well, the actual program is only calling that 3% of the time. So you can triple its effectiveness and you're going to get nothing out of the overall performance of the program.
Yeah.
And I think this is what ties back to, you know, that the premise here, which is why we're so bad at this, is like you look at the code that's in front of you and go, oh, I could do that better. But if you're spending 10 hours on it and it might not actually have an effect in the end, there's a bit of an ego thing that kind of goes with this. And I think it's an important skill as a programmer to figure out when to touch this stuff and when not.
I find that so hard, you know, this whole making that call between, premature optimization or just any optimization, really, if you're just fighting against, well, you could just wait, you know, sit out Moore's law for a little bit longer, and then you get, you know, that might be cheaper than spending the development hours on it. But at the same time, I think there's also that element, like you said, of personal pride or just enjoyment from, you know, a job well done and sort of having a really highly optimized and just nice implementation there. And I think that's psychologically just very difficult to not go down the wrong path there. Yeah, really interesting article.
Yeah, I think it, you know, the advice I usually give about it is basically trust the tools. So like write the code, run the code. It might be good enough, and then you've saved yourself the time. And if it's not good enough, then dig out the tools, profile it, and then figure out where to optimize.
Where's the program spending the time?
If it's the GIL that's getting in your way, I don't care how much time you spend on it. So like that's always one of those things, is try to figure it out. And it's I think where the psychological part of it comes into it is you tend to want to work on the function that's in front of you, right? And if that's where you're coding, then okay, well, this is what I'm going to optimize. So it can be hard.
Also reminds me of who coined this, make it run, make it right, make it fast. Was it Kent Beck or?
Okay. Yeah. I haven't heard that before, but that's
Uncle Bob or yeah, there's one of those from one of those TDD books. And yeah. That always resonated with me because it's such a short mantra to remember. Maybe a lot of times you can actually skip the third step, make it fast because it might just be fast enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of Python's mantra too.
Yeah,
that's true. Good enough, fast enough. The entire language is based on the fact that CPUs are fast now. Anyhow, so Professor Tratt has a fair number of blog posts. None of it is actually Python specific, but lots of it is really good general programming and sort of thoughts and advice in that space. So it's definitely worthwhile to dig around on his site. There's some good articles in there that you might learn some approach things, or you know, he spends a lot of space in the Unix and Linux world as well, so you might get some operating system tips from there as well. So there's some good content there.
I like that we are trying very often to go beyond the scope of just Pythonic stuff and think about like programming stuff, and you always kind of always bring that stuff. So again, to spread the mutual appreciation back, I appreciate that, Chris. So
it's equal parts. There's only so many articles in a week, and and general programming advice is general programming advice. Yeah. If you're coding, you're coding. It doesn't matter what language you're in. Mm-hmm. So.
This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It's the one that Christopher Trudeau has recently updated and is mentioning on the show. It's titled, SQLite and SQL Alchemy in Python. Move your data beyond flat files. The course is based on a RealPython article by Doug Farrell. And in the video course, my frequent co-host, Christopher Trudeau, shows you how to use flat files, such as CSVs for data storage. Then he digs into the basics of relational databases and how to start using SQLite for data storage. What are the different ways that SQL Alchemy can be used, including core text and core statements, and leading up to how SQL Alchemy can behave as an object relation mapper, or ORM, to work with data as Python objects. I think it's a good investment of your time to learn how Python, SQLite, and SQL Alchemy can give your programs database functionality, allowing you to store data in a single file without the need for a database server, and how an ORM can help you get past needing to learn the intricacies of SQL and start working with your data as Python objects. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. I think that lands us pretty squarely into our discussion topic.
Into the discussion, yeah. So the topic this week is based on a series of posts by Ryan Shelley, and it's called What is Error Culture? The concept can be summed up in a phrase most programmers have heard and far too many of us have uttered, which is, we don't know why that happens, and it doesn't seem to impact anything, so we're going to ignore it. So Ryan starts out by talking about the consequences of this sort of attitude. Once you start ignoring errors, there's sort of a question of whether the next error is one of those that should be ignored or not. And that often means it takes catastrophe before you're paying any sort of attention, because the error itself wasn't sufficient to make you and your team pay attention. So he talks about some reasons why this happens. The first is error fatigue, which is when you get too many errors or even just too many notifications. The next is a lack of understanding the error itself or why it's important. And finally, the lack of understanding the impact of the error, i.e. this doesn't hurt me, so it must not matter. Part two of the post talks about some causes of error culture, and part three talks about signs that you're in error culture. One of my favorites is when you have email rules that are sticking all the notifications that fit a certain pattern into a folder so that you never have to read them. Been there, done that. So he's got a great diagram on what to do about it. Nice little flow chart.
Yeah.
Starting out by analyzing if the error notification is necessary, If it isn't, get rid of it. If it is the error actually actionable? If it isn't actionable, then something's wrong. You need to make a change in your code so it is actionable or self-healing, and then it doesn't need to be addressed anymore. And then talks about things like, make sure it's documented so future folks know why this is happening and what the impact is. And then check that the right people are getting the notifications as well. So I thought Dan, being editor-in-chief, he's also sort of the keeper of all the real Python technology. Right. We've got a fairly complex system that handles thousands of views, a microsecond? I don't know how fast we go. You must have error notifications. How does real Python deal with this? How full is your inbox?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting one to talk about, to think about, because a lot of the things mentioned in the article I've definitely encountered at previous roles and then recently also with Real Python. And it is, again, like in that previous article, it really is like a psychological environment or problem, or the root cause is a people problem, not so much a technological problem, like you said, because it's easy to just fire notifications for all kinds of things. And then the challenge is actually like parsing, as the person like reading them, actually parsing out, understanding like what is important for me there. I think with Real Python, sort of the pattern that I settled on is I have two tiers of notifications. One is something that's typically more, well, I'm going to say metrics-based, so we have, we use a platform called Librado. It's some kind of hosted time services database you can pipe events into, and then you can plot them over time. And you can query it, and you can say, okay, well, if this number, say articles rendered in the last hour, or like quizzes completed in the last hour, signups in the last hour, if this number goes below a threshold or it kind of falls below a trend line, that is a notification then. And so that is kind of my early warning sign, because then I know, okay, well, there's maybe something there, but it might not be a problem, but something's definitely changed there. Let's take a look at it when I can. So it sort of goes into a little queue there for me. And then I have another monitoring platform that will actually call me on my phone and on my Apple Watch if the website goes down. So if we're actually starting to throw 500 errors on the health check, or the domain is unavailable, or we cannot, the system, that monitoring system cannot talk to our platform, that's like a hits the fan kind of moment for me, where I then like drop everything, run to the nearest computer, take my phone or whatever, and try and figure out what's going on. That's been quite a good system for me, I think, because it, like I said, it puts these notifications into two separate tiers, and if I have the one that's the really bad stuff, it's actually going to ring my phone. It's very annoying. So it's, I have it in my phone favorite. So it's even going to call, it's even going to ring my phone in the middle of the night, which thankfully, that rarely happens, but it would happen if the site goes down. And so I think that's helped a lot in keeping my sanity in with this topic, because you can start wondering about all kinds of things depending on how granular you go with these notifications. But that's been a really good system for me in terms of kind of the technical implementation of it. And I think the other aspect that I think that we're doing quite well at Real Python is just encouraging people to share when stuff seems broken, in the widest sense, where I always make a point of like when somebody goes in our chat system and says like, hey, I don't know, like this seems weird, like there's a text missing here, like this paragraph, some of the formatting doesn't work, or it's not rendering correctly, I'm not sure what's happening there. And just to always make a point of to thank the person and to take a look at it and sort of encourage that again in the future, because I think that helps offset some of that, what is mentioned in this error culture article of, oh, well, this looks broken, but there's so many other things broken, it's really not my problem, we're just going to glance over it and move on. And so just creating that culture of, everybody looking out for our publication and kind of the quality of the learner experience, I think that is really important. And I'm sure we could do more, and we could do this even better, but I always felt like that was an aspect that was working quite well.
You sort of mentioned something there that I've been a big proponent of with teams that I've managed. There is no stronger motivation behind writing high quality code than being the person who gets woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning when it fails. So when there is separation in an organization between the people who are responding to failure from the people who are writing the code that may be causing the failure, it's very easy to go, oh, well, you know, I go into office at 9 o'clock in the morning and I get notification that the server went down last night. Whereas when the pager or the modern equivalent of the pager, showing my age, goes off for the actual developers who are writing the code, they will tend to show more interest in things like unit testing because they don't want to be woken up.
Yeah.
And heaven help you if you go into the office and I was the one the pager went off for, and Mr. Bailey, it was your bug that caused it. You and I are going to have words because I woke up at 3 o'clock right in the morning. So there's like there's a cultural thing that can be done there that can, you know, help the teams themselves get to a place where they're building stuff where this stuff doesn't go off as often. So
yeah, and it really is a cultural thing. I think also with things like broken continuous integration. Right. Where I've worked on teams where, well, you know, the build pipeline's been read for the last 2 days. Like, it's fine. You know, we could still, we'll just go around and deploy to production. And that's usually the beginning of the end, right? That's like broken window effect squared, where nobody cares anymore about the quality. So, yeah.
Yeah. And like, there's subtleties to it as well. Like, back in my C days, I was very anal retentive. Like, warnings were not allowed. Right. And you can get by with ignoring a compiler warning. Most of the time, it doesn't matter. They're not errors. You can ignore them. And so, like, every once in a while, when I'll install something with pip and it'll have to compile something, and I'll watch the warnings go by, and I'm just like, oh God, like my OCD just does not like that, right? And again, it's the problem of if you let one warning go by, then, you know, then it turns into 10 warnings, and now they're scrolling past the screen. So when the 11th one gets added, you don't notice that the 11th one got added, and that 11th one might be the one you needed to pay attention to, right? So there's a sort of a, like you said, there's a cultural aspect of keeping a clean house.
Yeah, I had this experience with the job I was working in marketing. And again, I was very new to Python and very new to even using pandas. And there's this really common warning that I think every user of pandas have had. It's called setting with copy warning. And it appears when you do certain manipulations to your data frame, and I would run other people's code and I would see it. And I'm like, why is there this thing here? And I bring person over and they'd be like, oh, that's just a warning. And I'm like, okay, but why is it doing it? And they're like, oh yeah, don't worry about it. And I'm like, no, like I'm new to this concept and I'm having to be indoctrinated into this error culture, if you will, of just like, yeah, you just let those go. And so I actually was one of the things I was very interested in exploring when I joined Real Python, like, is there something to talk about this a little bit more? And it was one of the things I was going to try to write an article on. I never quite got to that point. We ended up finding someone else to do it, but it is kind of funny to watch these things happen. And had a recent example of that in like a physical example where I was driving home from Northern Colorado and my wife heard this like thunk at the front of the car. And I'm like, are there any lights? What's going on? She's like, I don't know. And then it started like rattling and so forth. And I said, you need to pull over. She's like, okay. And so we're like on a freeway and our back left tire had completely shredded, completely gone. And so I ended up having to get like all new tires and have them replaced. And the tires are nice now because they have like sensors in them, right? And I had the brand new tires on and I get home, everything looks fine, get in the car the next day and all of them have warning lights on again. And it's like, you know, trying to tell me that something's wrong. And I'm like, but they're brand new tires. And so I'm like calling people, asking them questions. They're like, oh yeah, it's probably fine. Just drive it for a little longer. It should be fine. So I finally go to the place and they're like, oh yeah, all the levels are too low. I'm like, I'm not going to ignore these things. So yeah, it's very easy in our world to just ignore because there's so many alarms around all of us all the time.
Yeah. And the phrase for this is something called alarm fatigue.
Yeah.
Ryan makes a very quick reference to it in the article, but there's a great episode of the 99% Invisible podcast that talks about it. And one of the things they mention is one of the causes of alarm fatigue is the fact that we traditionally use the same alarm sounds for everything.
Yeah.
And part of that is because it used to be hard to make different kinds of sounds. And so this is now what we associate with alarms. And the end result of that is you hear the beeping in the background and you don't know whether it's somebody set a stopwatch on their wristwatch or whether it's the patient down the hall who's going into VFib, right? So like, because they all just make the same little beep, beep, beep noise. And one of the things that the experts in the field are trying to do with this is change the idea of you have an attention noise and then you have a description noise. And the example that they talked about in the podcast is like a couple quick beeps to say, hey, I need your attention. And then the sound sounds like pills rattling in a bottle. And so now I know, oh, that beep beep was for that patient needs their meds updated. So I know that's not something that I have to do right now versus beep beep and then klaxon, meaning somebody's on fire and I should, you know, I should get up and go do something with that, right? The other thing this kind of ties to, he talks a bit about it in the article, is this the idea of hero culture. And again, this comes back to the people aspect, but we often reward those who fix the problem rather than those who prevent the problem. Because when you fix it, it's evident, right? Oh, the thing burst into flame and you were the first one to grab the fire extinguisher. Good for you. But nobody goes back and says, oh, wait a second. He was the one who installed the light switch faulty in the first place that caused the fire, right? And we see this in software all the time. And it has this subtle effect on your teams, because if you've got that hero culture, the folks who are doing the day-to-day to try to make sure things aren't bursting into flames aren't getting rewarded in the same way, aren't getting recognition in the same way. And
compared to the firefighters.
Yeah, right. And it's the extreme version of the hero culture is the whole arsonist firefighter problem, right? I created the fire and now I'm, you know, pin the medal on my chest because I was the one who put it out. And it all ties back to this sort of attitude of, oh, well, you know, it's good enough or whatever. And not fixing the warnings, not fixing the errors is kind of tied to that, because, you know, we're always in firefighting mode. And it can be a very difficult thing to do. And it's hard enough to get right with new teams, which is where it's easiest because you can start the culture.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard if you've got legacy code, right? Because I'm joining a team where, you know, compiling already has 300 errors and we get, you know, 15 email a day about the errors that are happening and we're supposed to ignore it all. Being the lone voice that stands up and says, we should spend time fixing that.
Yeah,
it's when management is going, just put out new features, right? Yeah. These things are problematic. They're hard to deal with.
It's the characters on the spaceship saying, you know, just shut that thing off.
yes, exactly. That's right.
Yeah, the hero culture one, or yeah, I guess that's what's called an article. That was an interesting one to me because, I mean, firefighting, it can be exhilarating. I mean, just the adrenaline rush of solving a problem, a big problem, sort of in production, that is, I find that guy quite rewarding, just sort of emotionally and dopamine levels wise. Like it's kind of a cool feeling, but I think it's also correct that you don't want to be in that mode where you have to, you know, usually slap on some kind of other quick fix and just kind of stack this Jenga tower of, you know, Band-Aid fixes higher and higher. You want to have ideally kind of the slowness and the space to be able to really get to root causes and not let things burst into flames there. And I thought that article, like, it really summarized that idea well with this little comic there that unfortunately is not going to come across if we try to explain it, I guess, as well as just looking at the thing. But I'm sure it's going to be linked in the show notes. Yeah, and I thought that was really something that kind of captured that very well, that whole idea that I liked a lot, yeah.
All right, well, we got a couple projects this week to dig into. I guess I'll go first here. My project, it's on GitHub under Omkar Cloud. At the very bottom of it, I finally found the person kind of working on it, Vande Mataram. But it's titled Botosaurus, with a subtitle, The All-in-One Framework to Build Awesome Scrapers. And if you've ever worked with web scraping and, you know, trying to automate that stuff in your life, you may have come across websites that refuse for you to be able to scrape information from them. And it can be a variety of things. Could be Cloudflare, could be JavaScript, could be all kinds of different things where it's not just a simple HTML doc that's there. And there's also other sort of countermeasures that have been put in place to avoid this. And so this person has created this library to basically create, they call it the most stealthiest framework for it to be able to go in and be able to pull information from this. And this kind of gets into a little bit of, you know, is this a positive thing? Is it a negative thing? Is there a legality thing here? And I don't want to address too much of that. I kind of wonder sometimes at the same point, like huge corporations are hoovering up all the data on the internet. I don't think an individual shouldn't be able to scrape a single thing off the internet themselves. At the same time, I don't think you should build a service off of this, maybe use an API instead. But if you are in a situation and you need to do some web scraping and you're interested in doing it and you're having problems with just using something like Beautiful Soup, this can augment it in a really kind of great way. It uses the undetected Chrome driver and something called Puppeteer Stealth and a bunch of other libraries to kind of help you with doing this stuff. You can set up parameters in it to skip images and CSS and other things. You can literally build a list of things that you like to avoid. It has actually rather detailed set of instructions in the GitHub post on it, kind of taking you into it. And I tried it out and I actually was working pretty well. Interestingly, their own website that they have in a lot of the examples was sort of out of commission the whole time I was trying it out during my research. But you can sub in whatever you need to. So again, if you're interested in web scraping, the other thing that I think was really neat about it is it has sort of a debugging mode. Because it is kind of like Selenium opening up a browser, you can kind of see the process as it's working through things, and it allows you to be more interactive in a sort of a debugging mode to work with it. So I was impressed with the library. And if you're interested in web scraping and need something that can maybe get past typically JavaScript or other things that are opening other elements, this might be a great tool for you. So what do you got, Chris?
My project this week is called Subby, and it's by Evgeny Blinov, who goes by the handle Pompunchik. Subby is a wrapper to Python's subprocess library, and its purpose is to provide shortcuts when you're calling out to operating system calls. The subprocess, if you've ever used it, can be a little finicky. It's one of those things I always find I have to go back to the docs to when I'm using it. When and how does it interact with standard out and standard error? Am I supposed to use the run call or the popen call? Some of that is from me just not using it frequently, and some of it is the fact that subprocess's run function takes 14 arguments, and those are the over and above the arguments that you're passing down to the command, right?
Argument fatigue.
And then you can go, oh, wait a second, run's not complicated enough, so let's popen as well. So anyhow, Evgeny's code abstracts all this away. You simply call the subby function, passing it the command arguments to the command that you want executed. Standard out and standard error happen in the terminal as usual, so you don't have to worry about them going away. But on top of that, the function also returns a subprocess result object, which includes the contents of standard out and standard error. So you sort of get the best of the both worlds. If you need it in the program, you've got it, and it doesn't stop it from happening on the terminals. The library also supports cancellation tokens and timeouts, does this through the Cantalk library, again, making it easier to deal with these kinds of error conditions without having to muck around with popen and threads and all that kind of stuff. So if you happen to find yourself in need of subprocess, this library can definitely save you some code, and more importantly, reduce the mental overhead of calling out to the shell. So in my best radio announcer voice, that's Christopher Bailey and episode 200.
That's great.
There you go. Great.
Well, I want to thank Dan Vader for coming on the show again.
Hey, thanks for having me. What an honor, you know, to be on the big 200. That's really amazing. I'll come back for 300 and 400 as well.
All right. I'll make sure to leave a space ready for that to go. And Christopher, thanks for rounding up all these articles and projects for, I guess, is it over 50 or is this the 50th time?
This is the 50th.
Okay,
this is
cool.
The 50th time. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So, again, everybody, if you haven't been checking out PyCoders and haven't signed up for it, please do. Always, there's links to everything that we've talked about in this episode. So, please check out the show notes. And we love feedback. You can leave us voicemails, as we have pointed out, by going to realpython.com/podcast. And you can also find us on the social stuff. And you can always send something to us at podcast@realpython.com. So thanks again. And don't forget, installing Sentry is just 5 lines of code. And RealPython listeners get 3 full months of the team plan for free with the code RealPython on signup. Check it out at sentry.io. I want to thank Christopher Trudeau and Dan Bader for helping me celebrate episode 200. And I want to thank you for listening to the RealPython podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the RealPython podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.